This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hello everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 375 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And great googly moogly, we have with us today, Mr. Mike Portnoy. Now, you likely know Mike as the world-renowned drummer for the Winery Dogs, Sons of Apollo, Liquid Tension Experiment, formerly of Dream Theater, and lots more. And today, he's not only talking about the new Winery Dogs LP, but also his extensive record collection and his approach to the hobby. Now, Mike has some amazing online videos going through his record collection. We deep dive into that today. We talk about Mike's approach to collecting, the rare records of his collection and career. We talk about meeting multiple Beatles and more, plus the new Winery Dogs LP, the Winery Dogs 3, out February 3rd. There's a few tracks on streaming services now. Go check them out, search up the Winery Dogs, and set yourself up to hear the whole album on February 3rd. And if you're new to the show, make sure you follow or subscribe to the Vinyl Guide podcast in your podcast app. Over 370 other episodes and interviews featuring the likes of Ben Blackwell of Third Man Records talking all about the White Stripes and Rare Records, episode 374, Kenny Jones of The Who, The Faces, The Small Faces, episode 339, Jack Endino talks about his time recording Nirvana and working for Sub Pop, episode 334. We even chat to John Petrucci of Dream Theater, episode 314. Carmine Appice, episode 313. Peter Frampton, episode 300. Tom Scholz of Boston, episode 297. Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, episode 293. And lots more. Follow, subscribe, and enjoy the Vinyl Guide podcast. And with that, grab some popcorn and let's get into our record nerdery with Mike and Mickey on the Portnoy Family Record Collection.
Hello.
Mr. Mike, how are you?
Good, man. How you doing?
Oh, man. I can see in the background. I'm in the Room of Doom. Look at that.
Oh, yeah.
Far
out. Oh, yeah. You can't even imagine what's going on in here.
I got to tell you, I've seen your videos on YouTube going through all your record cabinets and everything.
Oh, okay, cool.
You keep a very neat record room. I mean, most of them I see look like a disaster.
No. I'm a hoarder, but I'm an organized hoarder.
Okay. That, you know? I think they call that obsessive compulsive.
Exactly. Kind of. I am so completely OCD and everything obviously is alphabetized in chronological order. Even my t-shirt collection is alphabetical.
Wow. Yeah. You know, they have medication to help you with that. Anyway, hey, thanks for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Mike Portnoy, drummer of about a dozen projects you have in your record collection, Sons of Apollo, Liquid Tension Experiment, Dream Theater, Neil Morse Band, and of course, Winery Dogs. This week, we're celebrating the release of Winery Dogs 3 out February 3rd. There's a couple songs on streaming services now. You can go check it out and, you know, get ready for February 3rd. So, Mike, thanks for joining us again, mate. Good to see you.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Now, look, I understand after several years of relative quiet self-exile from the press, you've recently done some interviews, been misquoted, had some quotes perhaps taken out of context, made into clickbait. And let me reassure you, we are not a gossip show. We talk records. We talk vinyl collecting. We stick to the facts.
Excellent. Appreciate that.
No worries. All right. So first question, out of all the Winery Dogs, which one has the biggest penis? Go.
I don't know. None of us haven't talk about no clickbait.
That's okay. We know it's Billy. That's fine. All right. Look, the new album, it's a great record. I've had the privilege to listen to the whole thing early. Are you surprised that the album exists? I mean, was there a point where you thought maybe Winery Dogs had run its course?
No, I think we always knew we were going to come back for a third album. After the first two albums and tour cycles, you know, it was back to back, back to back. You know, it was, you know, it was 3 or 4 years of those two cycles back to back. I think after, you know, how busy that was, we wanted to take a step back, to catch our breath, do some of the things we do with some of our other bands. And we always knew we would reconvene. It was just a matter of, you know, when the time was right. And we got together in 2019 to play some live shows just for the fun of it. nothing new to promote, just for the fun of it. And we knew at that point, okay, yeah, it reignited the flame. And we knew at that point we had to make a third record. So it took a little longer than we thought because of the pandemic and the lockdown. So, you know, we kind of had to wait for the smoke to clear. But once it did, we got to work on it. And here we are.
Were you guys already? My dog. Oh, no worries. Well, let's see the dog.
Sorry about that. You can't do a winery dog interview without a barking dog in the background. Oh, that's Mickey.
The winery dogs are now a quartet. I see.
Yeah.
So were you guys already workshopping these songs in 2019? Have they been percolating long?
No, all not right. at all. That tour we did was just for the fun of it, just playing stuff from the first two albums. And when we came in to start this album in the summer of 21, it was a completely blank canvas. You know, so we just started with nothing and just started bouncing ideas off of each other. And that's, you know, that's how everything was put together.
Now, you guys, the timeline sounds like you recorded it while the pandemic was still a concern, still in the mind, but, you know, people were starting to move around a bit. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we went out to Richie's in LA, and I think that was my first time flying, you know, out to that session. It was my first time on a plane after everything. So yeah, when we started the sessions, you know, everyone was still in masks and all that stuff like that everywhere we went, in the restaurants and stuff like that. But yeah, at that point the smoke was clearing, and it was time to get back to work.
Mm-hmm. Now I gotta tell you, the musicianship is fantastic, as expected. The three of you guys get together, I mean, that's kind of almost table stakes. The thing I was most moved by on this new album is Richie's voice. I mean, there are a few, more than a few moments where he's like channeling an inner Chris Cornell. And I got to tell you, that's how good I think his performance is on this album.
Yeah. I mean, obviously his voice is incredible, and he brings so much soul to what he does. And, you know, I always view him as kind of like a modern day rock version of like Prince or something like that. But yeah. He actually will be the first to tell you Chris Cornell is not an influence on his, you know, I wouldn't even bring it up at this point, but you just brought it up. But yeah, he comes more from soulful, you know, Sam Cooke and Terrence Trent D'Arby and Prince, you know, that's kind of where he's coming from. And those are kind of his vocal heroes.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that was that's who struck me when I was listening to the album on a few moments there. Now, when you guys are making a Winery Dogs album, you're out in LA, you're recording the basic tracks. Are you still very close to what's happening with the songs while Richie continues working on them, adding lyrics and such?
No, you know, the three of us will arrange the foundation and the blueprint of the music together. You know, we spend a lot of time back and forth. Hey, let's try this and let's do that and let's add this, you know, just to the blueprint and the foundation. And once that's done, I recorded my drums like immediately after each song was kind of put together while it was fresh in my mind. But then we all go back home, and then that's when Richie does all the work on the lyrics and the melodies and the vocals. And that's all him. I mean, at that point, there's no need for me to be, you know, making suggestions or whatever. That's kind of his department. So,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. It's not until he records his vocals and then sends me those tracks where I'll add my harmonies and stuff like that and percussion, but that's after his process is done.
Are there times where you get the final mix and then you're hearing some things you may not have heard along the way?
Well, yeah, all three of us are, you know, listening to the mixes and making notes and, you know, tweaking that with Jay Rustin before we each sign off on it.
Now, I noticed February 3rd, the album's coming out. Again, a couple songs on streaming right now people can check out. I noticed there's no buy vinyl link yet. What's happening there?
Yeah, we will definitely be putting out on vinyl later in the year. But right now, you know, I know a lot of the vinyl manufacturing companies are way behind. And, you know, without getting into technicalities, we didn't have pictures for this album layout until like about a month ago, because Richie was out touring with his band throughout like August and September. And then as soon as he finished, I immediately was out touring in October and November. So there was no opportunity for the three of us together to get together and physically take pictures for the layout until like December. And at that point, you know, we were able to get the CD manufacturing in, but the vinyl manufacturing is way behind at this point. I guess, I don't know if it's a COVID thing where they're behind, but I don't know. But in any case, the vinyl is going to have to come a little further down the road, being that we could only get the layouts finished so close to release time.
Right. Okay. All right. Yeah. Vinyl backlogs are running now. They're improving now. I've heard 6 to 8 months, but that's still quite a while off. So we hope to hear back from you when that is available. So,
oh, don't worry. It'll be happening. I mean, I, as you know, I'm a vinyl collector, and that's my media of choice these days. So yeah, I can't have a new release of mine not on vinyl. You know, it would make me insane.
So watching your vinyl videos, which you have, and I highly recommend people to check them out on YouTube. Mike going through his vinyl collection. That's the new vinyl. That's the reissued vinyl. But you always point towards the back room, like, I've got thousands of records back there. Why do you separate them? Just curious there.
Well, my old records, I mean, my original collection that I had from the 60s and 70s and 80s, those were, you know, they're so beat to crap. You know, if you go through my Beatle collection, you know, they're literally the album covers are falling apart. You know, so once I switched over to CDs in the 80s, I still kept my collection, but they're beat to crap. So once vinyl started coming back, you know, 10, 20 years ago, whatever it was, I was like, all right, you know, I want to get all my favorite stuff again and get nice, pristine, clean copies where, you know, they're not beat to crap. And, you know, I can actually look at the artwork and enjoy them. So I still kept my old stuff, and I still have, you know, I don't know, thousands of records back there. But then now I've rebought everything in new, pristine, you know, reissued vinyl versions as well. But my collection here is insane because I have everything. You know, some of my favorite albums, I'm looking right here in front of me, I have Tommy on Reel to Reel.
Oh.
And I have, you know, this is, look at this. And I still have my 8-track collection. So some of my favorite albums I have on Reel to Reel, 8-track, cassette, old vinyl, new vinyl, CDs, you know, box sets. I try to collect a little bit of everything.
So let's explore that a little bit because, look, I'm the same way, and a lot of our listeners are as well, where you have a favorite album, you get different formats, even if you can't play those formats. Do you play them? They're just kind of like there to collect?
Like my 8-track collection, for instance, is just for nostalgia. You know, it's just so nostalgic to have these old Kiss albums on 8-track or these Pink Floyd albums on 8-track. Although Pink Floyd, like the 8-track for Animals is great because it's the only place you can get Pigs on the Wing 1 and 2 put together. But, you know, the sound quality on these 8-tracks are absolutely horrible, you know, and, you know, the songs are getting cut halfway through the program, and sometimes they change the album sequence. I mean, to have, like, Tommy on 8-track where they change the album sequence, you know, you can't change the sequence on a freaking concept album. But so, yeah, these 8-tracks are really more just for nostalgic purposes, just, you know, every once in a while I'll just pop them in, just kind of, you know, trip down memory lane.
But so you have a working player then. I actually
have two. I have one of these Dynamite boom boxes, and then I also have a rack mounted one as well into my stereo system.
Okay. And reel to reels. Do you have a reel to reel player?
No, I don't. But so yeah, some of this stuff is collectible. But you know, my honestly, you're gonna probably hate to hear this, but my preference, my listening preference is actually MP3s, which is, I know that's horrible to say, but I just love having everything here in my iTunes. You know, I have like 40,000 songs, like, you know, 600 gigs worth of stuff here in my iTunes. I just love having it all at my fingertips and being able to access anything as easily as you can. So as much as, like, you know, you're going to get a better sound quality on a CD, or you're going to get more of that natural, pristine sound on a vinyl, I just love the accessibility of MP3s. You know, whether I'm in a hotel room on my laptop or in my car on my, you know, off of my iPhone.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, pandemic aside, you probably spend 8 months on the road away from your collection. Exactly. So, you know.
Well, I remember back in the days when I first started touring, I had to bring a box of cassettes, you know, those big boxes with like 120 cassettes. And that's how I would listen to music and, you know, in my car or on tour. I can't even imagine what it was like in the 60s and 70s, lugging vinyl around in a little record player, you know. But then cassettes came, and that was the most portable way to listen to stuff. And then, of course, when the iPod came around, it was like, ah, you know.
We talked to some people who toured with Jimi Hendrix, and they used to lug around one of those big stereo systems, you know, the pieces of furniture.
Right.
That was part of the touring equipment, and wherever Jimmy was staying, they'd lug it up to the hotel room, even if it was second or third floor without an elevator. That was part of the job.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So, but do you ever explore that old vinyl? Do you ever go back there? Are you just kind of keeping it for nostalgic purposes because it's so connected to you?
Well, if I'm going to want to listen to, you know, something on vinyl, if I want to listen to, you know, The Who live at Leeds or whatever, you know, Paul McCartney's Ram, I'll pull out the modern vinyl. I want to hear, you know, the reissues because it's cleaner. It's not all scratched up like my old copies are. So, yeah, anytime I want to hear something that I have on a reissued vinyl, I'll go to the reissue rather than the old one. But inevitably, there's a lot of stuff in my old original collection that I don't have reissues of. So one of these, you know, every once in a while, it's like, okay, I want to listen to Procol Harum live with, you know, live in Edmonton with the Edmund Symphony Orchestra. It's like, all right, whatever. Well, I don't have that, the new one. So if I want to hear the snap, crackle, and pop on vinyl, I have to go to the original.
Mm. Now, what's your most precious record? And what I mean by that is like something that it doesn't need to be the most valuable, but the one that means the most to you. If your house was on fire, like what are a couple of records that you'd have to grab before you ran out?
Well, I would grab my iTunes because that's if I want the music, all the music is in my iTunes, literally everything in one place. But as far as vinyl, like if right here above my desk, I have some selected framed vinyl signed by the artist. So I guess these are my most precious ones. So looking up, I could tell you what I have here. I have Pink Floyd, The Wall, signed by Roger Waters and Nick Mason. I have Yes is Close to the Edge, signed by Chris Squire, John Anderson, Bill Bruford, Steve Howe, and Rick Wakeman. I got The Who's Tommy, signed by Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend. I have Kiss Alive 1, signed by Gene, Paul, Peter, and Ace. Pet Sounds, signed by Brian Wilson. Beatles Abbey Road, signed by Ringo. Rush's 2112, signed by Neil, Geddy, and Alex. Queen, A Night at the Opera, signed by Roger Taylor. So these are some of my most precious vinyls.
Did you get all those yourself directly?
Most of them, yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right. So
the only one I'm still missing, I have the Rolling Stones' Satanic Majesty's Request, which is a favorite of mine, just childhood memories. I'd love to get that signed one day. And I also have King Crimson and the Court of the Crimson King, which I'd love to get signed by Robert Fripp one of these days.
And I know how much of a Beatles nerd you are. So you've met Ringo.
I met Ringo and Paul, actually, yeah.
Oh, okay. Tell me about that. How was that? Because I know you're a bit of a fanboy. Do you still get starstruck?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, how can you not be starstruck by meeting a Beatle? You know, obviously. I've met pretty much most of my heroes at this point, and I don't get starstruck by many of them. But, you know, meeting Ringo and meeting Paul McCartney, those are as big as it gets. And in both cases, I had a great, great, great experience. I just recently posted a picture of me and Ringo and posted about the story of meeting him, which was great. It was a great experience. But meeting Paul was surreal because it was at a private party of his. And I was surrounded by all sorts of other stars. I mean, Paul Simon was there and Cameron Diaz and Fred Armisen and Steve Buscemi. It was just a room filled with stars. And sure enough, Paul McCartney was making the rounds and he comes over and talks to me and my daughter, engaging us in conversation. You know, I would have been happy to just shake his hand in 2 seconds. Nice to meet you, sir. You know, Sir Paul, you're my hero. That would have been enough for me. But he ended up standing there with me and my daughter for 10, 15 minutes, just engaging us in conversation. And that's incredibly inspiring that here you have one of the most famous musicians on the planet that is still open to conversation like that. And just so humble that, you know, he could hang out like that. So yeah, incredible experience it was.
Okay. He's probably just talking about casual things. Oh, what are you studying in school? And things like that.
Well, we were talking about, you know, actually I before I met him, knowing that I was going to meet, it's like, what do you ask him? What do I want to know from him that I don't already know? And I actually thought of a question to ask him and I did. And at that time it was like, hey, you know, what's going on with Let It Be? And all the Let It Be Get Back sessions. And, you know, at that point, Get Back hadn't come out yet. And there was no news or word of it at that point when I met him. This was like maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago. And yeah, he gave me the scoop at that point. He's like, oh, we're working through the tapes and we're eventually going to be putting it out for around the 50th anniversary and stuff. So I actually got some info from him that I really wanted to know and didn't know the answer to. But it, I also got, we also talked about other stuff, you know, the set list that from the tour he was doing. We were talking about how great his band is. And I was telling him the story how my mom and dad were at Shea Stadium in 66. And I was in my mom, I was, you know, my mom was pregnant with me seeing the Beatles at Shea in 66. So I guess that was technically my first concert.
That may have shaped you more than you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Man, how great is that? Was that that Get Back series? I mean,
oh, incredible.
It made me revisit Let It Be in a whole new light. Obviously, it was never my favorite Beatles album, but then it shot up to probably one of the top three just through that experience.
Absolutely.
Are you a bit of a box set collector? You like box sets?
Oh, big time. If you look over my shoulder right there, those are all my box sets. And I collect them all when they come out. So I bought all the Metallica box sets that have come out so far. I bought all the Zeppelin box sets when they were doing those, bought all the Pink Floyd box sets, their series. What else have I? I have all the Beatle 50th anniversary boxes, obviously. All the McCartney reissues, all the Crimson boxes. So, yeah, I'm a big collector of all that stuff.
Did you see the Pink Floyd 50th Dark Side they announced today?
Yeah, yeah. Although, I mean, when they did their immersion reissues, you know, they did Dark Side, they did Wish You Were Here, they did The Wall, and then they put out that early years box. I mean, they've been very, very thorough so far in their releases. I can't imagine what they're going to do to top the immersion box for Dark Side, but sure enough, I'll buy it.
Yeah, I've got to start being really selective on those things, not only from a money standpoint, but also just the room and the time. So I've probably got five copies of Dark Side of the Moon. I'm not entirely sure what that box set's going to bring to me, or right, whether I'll be able to give it the proper amount of time. But you sit down and you seem to be very thorough. You go through all the outtakes and
I do. I whenever I get a box set, first thing I'll do is I'll rip the CDs. So for listening, it's way more convenient for me to listen, like I said, you know, off my laptop in a hotel room or with headphones, off my phone. So yeah, I'll immediately rip all the CDs just for easy access. And then I'll obviously go through the booklets and all the paraphernalia and all that stuff. But yeah, some of them are so detailed. Like these Metallica box sets are so thorough. There's so much there. And the Zeppelin box sets that they put out was really, really a great series. So, yeah, I love all this stuff, and I get way into it. The Beatles boxes, you know, the 50th anniversary remixes that they've been putting out had just been phenomenal.
Mm. What's the most you've ever paid for a record?
Probably some of these box sets. You know, they go for $250. Some of them are, you know, upwards of $300. I'm not like the type to go to an old record store and buy, you know, oh, this is like the early pressing on Capitol Records and it has a misspelling on one of the words and, you know, there it is for $500. I'm not a collector like that. You know, I know people that are. So for me, it's more the big box sets that are very usually very expensive, and I will always buy them. I always take the plunge and buy them.
Mm-hmm. Well, where do you shop? Do you shop online? Do you have local stores you go to?
There's a few local ones by me. I'm in Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania, and there's a few shops around here that I'll go to shop or get new stuff. But honestly, I hate to say this because it's been so bad for the record industry or record stores, but it's just so convenient to shop these days. So, you know, I will admit a lot of the times I'll just get something on Amazon or buy it off of the band's website, you know, Rush's website or the King Crimson website, or, you know, do it that way.
Yeah, look, there's Amazon fills this gap in the market where there's not a lot of record stores around. People don't always have that convenience, and especially, I mean, pandemic aside, you know, it's a service that works for a lot of people. And right. But you're right. I always try to buy it off the artist website first because I feel that's probably the most direct way to support the band.
Well, like for instance, I just, you know, King Crimson put out a 50th anniversary documentary months ago, and it was in theaters and they released the Blu-ray, but it's still not streaming. So I've been waiting for it to stream on one of these channels so I could see it. And it still doesn't have a streaming deal. So I just said, you know what? Fuck it. I'm tired of waiting for this thing. So I went to the Crimson website and just bought the Blu-ray box set, which is cool anyway, because it has all this great paraphernalia in it. It's got bonus CDs with music and everything. So yeah, whenever I could buy directly from the artist, I try to.
Mm-hmm. So in watching your videos, I learned something very interesting. You're a fan of the work of Kevin Gilbert.
Oh, yeah.
And me too. In fact, we grew up in the same neighborhood, kind of ran around out of the same circles. And I understand you were in discussions with him to produce Dream Theater's Falling Into Infinity.
Correct, yeah.
Tell me about that relationship that you formed with Kevin.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
In watching your videos, I learned something very interesting. You're a fan of the work of Kevin Gilbert.
Oh, yeah.
And me too. In fact, we grew up in the same neighborhood, kind of ran around out of the same circles. And I understand you were in discussions with him to produce Dream Theater's Falling Into Infinity.
Correct. Yeah.
Tell me about that relationship that you formed with Kevin.
Well, I didn't get to have a real relationship with him. We kind of just spoke a few times, but you know, that was around 96 or 7. And I was a big fan of his. I was a big fan of the Toy Matinee album. And I was a big fan of his first solo album. I guess it was Thud at the time. And then I was also good friends with Nick DiVirgilio, who was working on Shaming of the True at the time with Kevin when he passed. And also I was also becoming friends with Neil Morse at that time as well. And Kevin was working with Spock's Beard as well. So, you know, I kind of met Kevin through Neil Morse and Nick DiVirgilio. And Dream Theater was looking for a producer for Falling Into Infinity at that time. And, you know, I just threw his name out there and, you know, I turned the rest of the band on to Kevin's work, just how great it sounded sonically and, you know, how great artistically he was. So, yeah, I reached out to Kevin and sent him some of the demos we were working on at the time. And it was actually only about a week or two later that he passed away. So we never got further than that discussion part, you know, and trading, you know, messages and emails and voice messages on our phones. And that was pretty much the extent of my personal contact with him, because sadly he passed away right after we started talking.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So you'd never ended up meeting him in person or
seeing the show? No, I never met him in person. We only were just talking on the phone and sending each other stuff.
Yeah.
In the mail and in email.
Yeah. Oh man, what a talent. Did you ever get a copy of Shaming of the True on vinyl?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, they his estate sent me a copy actually, and I actually at the time had an early version of a working version of Shaming of the True on DAT that Nick sent me when they were still working on it, and it wasn't complete yet. And then when it was finally completed and put out, it became a favorite of mine.
Speaking of vinyl, Winery Dogs, just a quick question: do you have any idea how collectible the Winery Dogs vinyl albums are?
I don't. I'm not sure, but I would think probably the most collectible thing the Winery Dogs have is we put out a dog treats box set after the first album. And in it is all these things like a wine bottle stopper and early demos of the songs and alternate versions. And so, yeah, that's probably the most collectible Winery Dogs item, but it's not vinyl per se. It was CD items and booklets and things like that in the box set.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing with the winery pups in it. And
exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. So there's a few other things that are, I mean, they're quite collectible. So the debut LP, the 2013 debut LP, typically goes for about $150, $200 on the secondary market.
Wow. I have a closet full of them.
Well, hey, there you go.
I didn't know that.
There's your retirement portfolio.
Yeah.
Unleashed in Japan goes for around $150.
Wow.
Hot Streak is nearly $100. I mean, everything the Winery Dogs puts out, you know, it seems to be highly in demand and, you know, garners a bit of a premium. So I'll probably ask a rather obvious question. Do you foresee any of these titles being eventually reissued on vinyl?
I surely would love to do it. I'm not sure if Billy or Richie are vinyl collectors the same way I am, to the extent I am. But I'm always looking out for the collectors, and to me, that's an important thing. So, Billy, Richie, and myself, we are the label at this point, because Loud and Proud, that we did our first two records with, went under over the last few years. So maybe that's why those first two albums, are harder to find and out of print perhaps. So, maybe I could possibly talk Richie and Billy into taking the plunge to reissuing the first two as well, or maybe the live stuff as well. But at the moment, we're just focusing on the first, sure, the new album.
I foresee a future with a merch table full of depleting vinyl. So hopefully that comes to pass. Now, continuing our record talk here, while in Dream Theater, you had the privilege to work with the great Storm Thurgeson, the artist many people know behind Hypnosis, made many legendary album covers. Tell me about your interactions with Storm.
He was a legendary guy that I always wanted to work with. You know, being such a Pink Floyd fan, he did all the Floyd stuff. He also did all the classic Zeppelin albums. Just a legendary artist. And we were looking for somebody to work with, and I think I suggested him. And, you know, I had the honor of being the point person and working with him hand in hand throughout the process. And the great thing about Storm is that he would start by hand drawing all of his ideas and send you like maybe 10 different paintings, hand drawn like paintings of ideas to work with. And then once you pick the one you like, then he actually would literally go photograph these images. You know, he was very old school in that respect. It wasn't all done with Photoshop and stuff like that. So it was great when we were working on Falling Into Infinity. He sent me like 10 different hand-drawn ideas and sketches. And the one I have it hanging in the other room. I can't carry the computer with me, but one of them was a painting of what became the cover of Falling Into Infinity that we liked. And we said, okay, let's go with that. But the other one that was on the same page was a sketch that we passed on, but he ended up using it for Pink Floyd Echoes, their best of album. So I literally have Storm's hand-drawn sketch that we turned down and Pink Floyd used for their Echoes compilation.
Wow.
I have it hanging in the other room. But yeah, he was just a crazy, legendary artist. And what an honor to have done a few covers with him. He did Falling Into Infinity, and he also did the live album that followed, Once in a Lifetime.
So the process of his creativity, did you guys talked concepts and ideas?
Yeah.
Did he hear some of the music first?
I don't think so. It was more the song titles and the lyrics. And it's the same with the relationship I had with working with Hugh Syme. You know, after I think my last three or four albums for Dream Theater, I worked hand in hand with Hugh Syme on all those layouts. And it was the same kind of process, giving him lyrics and titles and then just powwowing ideas of different visuals or metaphors that would work with the titles. And yeah, working with both Storm and Hugh Syme were both incredible experiences.
You also mentioned in your videos that the Dream Theater logo, he had to almost customize it for each cover. He wouldn't use the original logo.
The only two Dream Theater albums that don't have the classic logo are the two that Storm did, which was Falling Into Infinity and Once in a Lifetime, only because he didn't like working with pre-existing fonts or logos. He wanted to be able to create different things for the different artworks. And, you know, that's the way he did it with Pink Floyd and stuff. So we were only three albums in at that point. So, you know, our first album had a different font than Images and Words and Awake did. So we only had at that point two or three albums with the classic Dream Theater font. So we were open to, you know, if that's the way Storm works, okay, let's do it. And in the end, I kind of wish we hadn't, because it's weird that, you know, those two albums were the only ones that didn't have the classic font once we established it with Images and Words. So, but, you know, if you're working with somebody that legendary, if that's what he wants to do and that's the way he works, you kind of want to respect it.
Yeah. He's the doctor. You got to take the medicine.
Exactly.
All right. So let's talk about the band you really rose to fame with, Rising Power. Power for the People, the CD. Tell me about this.
Oh, my God. I can't believe you even know about it. Well, that was my first original band. My first band was a band called Intruder, and that was formed in junior high school when I was 13 or 14, and that was just playing covers. But my first band of original music was Rising Power, and I think I was around 16 at the time. Me and the bass player were both, 16 or 17 years old. But then the singer, guitar player, was a guy named Pete Best. Peter Best. No relationship to Pete Best from the Beatles. But he was significantly older than us. He was about 15 years older than we were. He was in his 30s at the time, and we were just teenagers. But he was my neighbor that lived across the street, and he played guitar and sang. So we just put together Rising Power, and that was my first experience writing original music and playing original music. And yeah, that's the oldest thing out there with me drumming on it, because I think I was 16 or 17 at the time.
Okay. All right. And though it's out there on YouTube, I guess people can enjoy it there. But suffice to say, you've come a long way since those days.
Yeah. Well, Dream Theater was formed not long after. I met John Petrucci and John Myung at Berklee College of Music when we were 18. So, it wasn't very far into my playing career that Dream Theater was formed. You know, we formed the band as teenagers. So, yeah, once that happened, then that was pretty much the next 25 years of my career.
All right. So present date, The Winery Dogs 3 coming out February 3rd. You guys have a tour starting out. Where is this tour taking you guys?
Well, we'll be out all across the whole planet throughout 2023. You know, we're starting with a U.S. leg in February, March, and April. It's pretty thorough. It's about 7 weeks long, which is very long by American tour standards. And even at that length, with 35, 40 shows, we're still only covering half of the country. So we're not even making it to the West Coast on this first leg. So we'll get to the West Coast with a second leg maybe in May or so. But that's the U.S. We go down to Brazil for some festivals and the end of April. We have some festivals in Europe in June and some one-offs over there. And then later in the year, we'll have a more thorough European tour and a more thorough South American tour, and we'll get over to Japan and stuff. So as of now, we have, we're booked up through November at this point, even though we haven't announced all those dates yet. But it's going to be a very thorough tour, a lot of ground covered and a lot of shows played, and a very busy year all year long for the three of us.
All right. And how about overseas? Japan, Australia, any of those coming up?
Japan's already on the map. We already have dates booked there that haven't been announced yet. So those will be announced at a certain point later in the year. Nothing for Australia yet, but we'd love for that to happen. And then, like I said, we're going to have a more thorough South American run as well. But that will be announced later in the year as well.
Is touring pretty much stabilized now? Because I know for a while it was, you know, a lot of people were kind of sketchy about going out.
Yeah, no, it's pretty much back to normal. As of last year in 2022, I did two European tours with Transatlantic and Neil Morse Band, and I did a South American tour with Sons of Apollo. So yeah, I think the world is back to normal, thank God.
So Mike, I mentioned a couple of times, you know, that you've got these videos going through your vinyl collection. I think there's 8 of them or something like that. What prompted you to do those videos? What inspired you to do those?
It was the start of COVID and lockdown, and I was literally locked in my basement, you know, for a year, unable to tour. So, you know, sitting, you know, you could see in the video here, my surroundings, I'm surrounded by tens of thousands of records and CDs and DVDs and Blu-rays. And I just felt like, okay, well, I guess it's a good time to go through my vinyl collection and maybe share it with people that might be interested. And, you know, everybody was doing these COVID collaboration videos locked at home. It was just a way to kind of keep busy and keep interactive and post stuff on my social media, being I really didn't have anything on, you know, as far as touring and being able to play live and connect with people in person. So it was kind of just a way to stay connected with the fan base and, you know, tap into my fellow vinyl collectors.
Mm-hmm. And you did a marvelous job. I mean, all the records you went through, you told the stories about them, what those records meant to you, a little bit of history on the record for people who right. may not be familiar with it. I mean, it's a really interesting musical adventure. So I'd encourage anyone who's got access to YouTube, which is pretty much everyone, to check out Mike Portnoy's, what is it, record collection videos?
The hashtag is MP Vinyl. But if you go to my YouTube page, all eight videos in the series are right on my YouTube page.
Now, are you getting packages of records like every day? Like there's something new on the doorstep every day?
Not every day, but frequently. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I'm awaiting the latest box set from Inside Out Music, you know, of all the latest stuff. Luckily, record companies that I work with are very gracious with that. In fact, I just spoke to Metal Blade a few days ago about sending me some stuff I was looking for from Fate's Warning and Slayer and Merciful Fate and King Diamond. So, yeah, every once in a while I get these goodie packages and it's always exciting.
Now, that's interesting because some labels send you stuff proactively, even stuff that's not yours. And then I've right. noticed that you also say, oh, the record, I played on this record, but the record company never sent me a copy. Yeah. So it's...
There are a few that I'm on that I still don't have, but yeah.
What's the hardest to find record that you are on?
Probably Dream Theater's first album, When Dream and Day Unite. I mean, that's been out of print since the 80s or early 90s. And I have a closet full of them, actually. But that's probably the hardest one to find, I would think.
Okay. So was there a U.S. pressing of that, or was that out of Germany?
It was the original pressing, which I have, was on MCA Records. We were signed to Mechanic MCA at the time. And when we put out that album in March of 89, was it on CD? Oh, yeah, it was on CD, I believe, as well. But it was still at the time where vinyl was the main format. So, yeah, it did have a proper release at the time. But then when we put out our second album, Images and Words, in 92, I think at that point, vinyl was no longer coming out in America. So the only release of Images and Words and Awake at that point in the early 90s was some German imports. But obviously now, since in the age of reissues, all that stuff has been reissued. But I don't think the first album has been reissued yet.
Oh, okay. And you seem to have this closet, this magic closet full of boxes of records.
I do.
Yeah. I mean, when we're talking a box, are we talking 50 copies? Are we talking a dozen copies? What are we talking on those?
In some cases, it's 50 plus. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with them all?
I mean, I'm the collector, obviously, as you could see. So anytime I put out any release, I always have the label send me 3 to 5 copies of each format. If they do multiple colored vinyl, I want copies of each color. So yeah, I actually have one of everything for my own collection, but in some cases, 3 to 5 to 10 copies of, stock here that I use to give to friends and fans and other fellow collectors.
Ah, a true archivist. So is there anything you're missing that you're on?
I am. I'm missing, believe it or not, Dream Theater's A Change of Seasons, which was reissued and nobody ever sent me a copy. And that's the craziest thing of all, because that is the most personal song I ever wrote. I wrote that song in the lyrics about my mom passing in a plane crash. So it has a real personal history to me and connection to me. And it's crazy. That's one of the only things of mine that I don't have on vinyl. So Dream Theater guys or label or music on vinyl, whoever put out that reissue, please send me a fucking copy. Jesus.
I'll call John. I'll see if we can sort you out. all right, Mike, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. And again, I want to remind everyone, The Winery Dogs 3 out February 3rd. Go to your streaming services now. Check out the first couple songs. I think it's Xanadu and Mad World. And the rest of the album is absolutely stellar. So set yourself up to be able to get it on the day it comes out. And also check out the WineryDogs.com for tour dates. If they're anywhere near you, you got to see this band. I mean, Richie Kotzen, Mike Portnoy, Billy Sheehan. I mean, the musicianship is just – that it's going to be a fantastic show.
Thank you.
There we go, Mike and Mickey. Thank you for joining us here on the Vinyl Guy.
Mickey made his first Winery Dog interview appearance.
Yeah. Mike, thanks again, sir. And we'll see you on the road, mate.
Thank you, man. Good speaking to you.
All right. Take care. Cheers.
Take care, man. Bye-bye.
All right, there we have it, Mr. Mike Portnoy. Thank you so much for coming by the Vinyl Guide podcast. Quick note, we've had Mike on the show before episode 116, way, way long ago in 2018. So make sure you dial up that episode if you so enjoy. And by the way, just a reminder, we have a Patreon page. If you like this podcast and want to help support the show, patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support the Vinyl Guide podcast, and we throw up lots of extras, including commercial-free episodes, extended episodes, and high-resolution audio files. That's patreon.com/vinylguide, where you get to hear the rest of the show. And that is it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Share them out on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, share them on Instagram. Post them to different Reddit groups and Facebook groups. That is always hugely helpful. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.